I'm Jeff Cohen. Dr. Jonathan Field is an allergist immunologist in the New York area. His journey to Jewish observance was positively influenced by his sister. He was also set up for success by some timely geographic moves. He's here to share his story, which I really appreciate, by the way, because I assume that allergists are really, really busy in the spring. Dr. Field, welcome to Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here.
And I was thinking before the interview, you must be so busy that maybe we should have you seeing live patients during the interview just so you can stay on track.
You might hear some chime in. You never know.
Fair enough. So let's get to know you a little bit. Let's hear your story. And I think in your story, it'd be good to even start with your parents or grandparents to kind of set the stage for where they were holding religiously before you even come into the picture.
Absolutely. So I'm a fourth generation Southern Jew. I grew up in Atlanta. My great grandparents, my mother's grandparents immigrated from Russia to Georgia in the 1880s. My grandparents, believe it or not, on both sides were born here. And my parents, of course, grew up in Atlanta, where I grew up, and I lived there till I was 26 years old. Religiously, the elders, 80s and Bubbies, they were obviously very religious. And even my mother's grandparents were religious. Really, the generation that changed was my grandparents in the 40s and 50s with the nascent conservative movement that really took hold in Atlanta in a strong way. It's interesting. Atlanta was unique that they had a very strong reform movement. If you've ever seen Driving Miss Daisy from the 1860s, classical German reform, the Russians were, you know, the Nukschleppers. They came later in the 1880s, and they remained religious really for the most part till the 40s and 50s. And again, the conservative movement took hold, and that's really when my grandparents and my parents' generations became conservative. Of course, conservative Judaism has obviously changed over time, but observance generally dropped. By the time I was coming of age, you know, we had Sunday school, and we had maybe one or two nights a week, which is a complete failure after going from regular school, having to go for 2 hours to another part of town to school, and, you know, trying to learn. So there was obviously, Eurytus Doris, really within, I guess, my parents' and grandparents' generation, but they still had some ties. And I think I credit this in addition, and we'll talk more about my sister, but just really having it wasn't completely foreign because we had, in my parents' memory, we had, you know, grandparents that were observant.
And so your story is in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where your entire childhood takes place. And you've given us a good sense of some of the things religiously where you were holding. Were you celebrating the holidays? Like, what was your Hanukkah like? What was Pesach like?
So again, we went to shul. You know, it was basically, we had Friday night dinner. I remember that very distinctly at our house or other family members. And obviously we drove, we weren't Shomer Shabbos. But I remember, you know, lighting candles, things like that. And we would go sometimes Shabbos day if it was a bar mitzvah, or we would go, you know, nominally for holidays. Obviously the big two, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah. But observance was, you know, it was, you know, in a assimilated way. You know, we obviously had Hanukkah, but I was in the school choir. You know, we sang Christmas songs, things like that. We played sports, which obviously were on Shabbos. I mean, we knew that we were Jewish. The conservative movement was strongly Jewish. And again, it was unusual because it was like, well, we're not, you know, Orthodox, that's so far removed, but we're not like so fry like the, you know, the very assimilated reform. I mean, again, I refer to the movie Driving Miss Daisy, but it's true. There was a real dichotomy there. So we were just really, you know, what you would say, conservative in the middle of the road standpoint, you know, basic stuff. I don't remember going for Shavuos ever when I was a kid. And maybe we went for Simchas Torah because it was fun as the camera was a little kid. But again, there wasn't really strong observance. There certainly wasn't, other than learning my Haftarah for my bar mitzvah. There wasn't really any learning. But again, we had a concept of Shabbos, but it was very nominal at best.
And school-wise, you said you were in public school from kindergarten through 12th grade?
So all the way, yeah, sure. And again, they had, the conservative movement had a Hebrew day school, Sundays and twice a week. You know, there was a Hebrew academy, there was a high school, and I had a few friends that went there, but then we always had the Jew crew, we always had kids that were Jewish that went there. And it's interesting, my particular school, I guess because it was near the Emory campus and the medical school, tended to be more of a, you know, a conservative group. There were a couple of kids I remember even kept kosher and brought their own food, and I remember knowing that in the school cafeteria, like, you know, I knew enough to say, you know, when they served me, like, well, we're not supposed to drink milk. Because one of my friends, he's like, well, we don't do that. I'm like, okay, if you say so. But that was really about it.
And did you feel like as your bar mitzvah was approaching that that might be the end of the line in terms of your Judaism? Like, how did you think you'd be holding post bar mitzvah?
So it's interesting. We had something called confirmation. I don't know if you're familiar with this, that at 16, if you stayed on for a couple other years, you got confirmed. And it was usually at the end of the school year. It might have even been Shavuos now that I think about it. They gave you a Tanakh in English. I still have it, like cover to cover. And after that, you kind of knew that was really it. You know, maybe you'd join a Jewish fraternity if you went to school. And we had family get-togethers. And every once in a while, we'd celebrate Shabbat. But, you know, other things obviously got in the way. Sports, hanging out with friends, dating, all the usual high school, early college things. Again, college, I mentioned fraternity. There was obviously Jewish fraternities, and they would have certain things. But again, very nominal. So I would say it was the end of the line. But I think in terms of any prep and learning and involvement, it was probably the most intense year of any at the tender age of 13. And I really didn't see it going on much further than that. I mean, I remember, again, we had cousins, you know, every family, we always joke in Irish families, they may have like a family member that's a police officer. We always had one or two cousins that were religious. I remember going to their house and I wasn't mesmerized by it at the time. I thought it was very nice, but you know, there was always a little bit of discomfort that you knew you were looked down upon a little bit, maybe because you weren't religious, but it wasn't enough to motivate you to do more, unfortunately, at that level. You know, I wish I had the insight at the time. It would have been great at 13, 15 to really, you know, buy into that, but I wasn't holding there at that time.
Now, I also introduced you as a doctor. So as we think about those post-bar mitzvah years, did you already know that was the profession you were heading towards? And did your college choice have a lot to do with wanting to get into the medical field?
Yes and no. I always wanted to be a doctor from an early, early age. In a young age, I was my sister's roughhousing, and I think I still have a scar from it, threw me against the fireplace, ended up going to the emergency room. And I remember with my parents, you know, they call doctor such and such. I'm like, that sounds great. They're like, oh, you want to be a doctor? So I always wanted to be a doctor from an early age. College and things, it was really, frankly, as I said, I went to public school. We weren't well-to-do or wealthy or anything like that. So I went, you know, where I got a scholarship to the state school, and it was more of a choice that I could get a good education and not come out $1 million in debt. I knew they had campus life. I knew they had a Hillel. So I knew there was some nominal Judaism, but it wasn't a huge decision. It was close enough to, it was far enough away where you had to get in a car, but close enough if you wanted to go home for holidays, it wasn't a big deal. But no, it didn't really factor in. What really did, and I don't want to get too far on myself, was medical school. The campus, if you're familiar at all with Atlanta, where school is pretty close to the Jewish community. So that was actually very influential. And that ties into what you'd mentioned earlier about my sister, you know, being very influential. At that same time, toward the end of college, beginning of medical school, my sister got married. She's a little bit older than me. And so she was already married, and she married a guy, Southerner. We kept it below the Mason-Dixon line. He was from Norfolk, Virginia, and he grew up in a more traditional Orthodox home. So she became observant. They were very welcoming. They're like, come for Shabbat. We don't care if you drive or whatever. But I like what I saw. I enjoyed it. You know, I was already in at the end of college and or then going into medical school. So, you know, weeks were very hectic, very intense, and it was just nice to unwind a little bit. There wasn't television, radio blaring. And I don't know, it struck a chord, just the nature of it. So they were very influential. And again, when I started going to do rotations, the University Hospital at Emory is near the Beth Jacob Synagogue. That was the main, or now there's many of them 25 years later, but that was the main religious neighborhood. It's very close to the medical campus. And they set me up, my brother-in-law, he learned every week. He went to just a Torah class with a rabbi there, Rabbi Daniel S. Stryker. I'll give a shout out. Wonderful man, a real tzaddik. And I started going again. I knew really nothing. I could follow along a little bit, you know, what he was talking about, but I liked him. He was very passionate about teaching Torah, whether it was just something basic about observance or, you know, the weekly, whatever. You know, they made a suggestion, you know, why don't you come for Shabbos? As all Southerners, you know, we're very hospitable. Why don't you come? Sure, I'll come for Shabbos. Why not? And there was a couple in the community that their kids were, I think, in college and law school, and they were kind of early empty nesters. They're like, look, you can come here, you can stay for Shabbos, or you can drive, and they didn't care. They're like, come Saturday. You have to know, Beth Jacob was founded by Baal Teshuva, so they were very open. I don't think they ever closed the parking lot. They wanted people to come. You know, by example, they weren't the type where they turned people away. So it was a nice community in that, and it still is today. So I started going for Shabbos, and at first I would go home to my home after Shabbos lunch, and then after a while with this couple, I started staying every Shabbos, and that was really a slow assimilation into observance. And again, I attribute, like I said, my sister and brother-in-law, this Rabbi S. Stryker, and certainly this couple, their names Lynn and Ed Kofsky, wonderful people from Atlanta, and they were just, you know, please come stay, and it really grew on me, and it was a very slow over 3 to 4 years of medical school. And that was really the genesis of it. It wasn't some revelation. I didn't have a point of, oh my gosh, you know, I've lost everything. I'm turning to Judaism. I was already, you know, Jewish. It was just, I guess, the presentation between my sister and brother-in-law and this rabbi and couple and just the community as a whole. And no one was judgmental. And, you know, this was in the 90s. Then Kiruv was really starting to become a thing, I think, beyond just, you know, what we think of today with Chabad, but really people becoming more observant through programs. I mean, you know, Aish, obviously, the things we know of in the Northeast. But in the South, this was a little bit more grassroots movement, if you will.
By the way, I hear some of the honking in the background. I assume that's people who are like desperately trying to get in for their allergy shots for the spring season.
Could be. Yeah. Would you mind if we take a quick break?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. I'll be back. Bye. Back in the studio. Thank you, guys. Anyways, where were we?
Now, I said in the introduction that allergists are really, really busy this time of year, and it's hard for our listeners to understand this because this is an audio podcast, but Dr. Field literally took a break to go give some allergy shots to some needy patients, and now we're back to pick up the interview. Is that right?
That's correct. Back and ready to talk more.
So I want to go back to your story now. There's a few things I just want to cover from what you just said. The first thing that jumped out to me is your sister married somebody who was religious. What point was she at that they met as a couple and it seemed like a good match? Because if she was raised like you, she had a little bit of a journey to go on her own before maybe they would be the right match religious-wise.
Correct. You know, I think like myself, you know, we were more traditional, being, you know, conservative, but I think she was also the one, she was old enough, you know, she would take me to Sunday school and she was always involved with the holidays helping my mom. So I think she already had a little bit more of a bent toward observance. I think it was just when she met my brother-in-law-to-be, I think they just really hit it off. Again, similar values. Southern Orthodoxy, I always say, like I have friends who live in Florida, they say Florida from is different from elsewhere. Southern from, we're just so glad to have other Jews. And I think, you know, I don't think it's as much of a jump. Perhaps it implies, you know, less religiosity. But in general, I don't think the jump for her was that. So, you know, certainly being Shomer Shabbos and certainly keeping a kosher home were big. She was already at the point, she was already in her mid-20s, so she had friends that either grown up religious from camp or from just, you know, BBYO, like youth basketball or things like that. So I think she already had, and again, we had cousins more her age that were religious. So I don't think it was such a stretch. And again, her husband, they were, again, very, and I don't like to use modern or, you know, right or left, but I think they were a little bit more, again, growing up in Norfolk, another Southern, even smaller Southern community, I think your brand of Orthodoxy is much more inclusive. If you live somewhere where you've got every stripe, you can be as center line as you want. Whereas in the South, I think in a place like Atlanta or in a small place like Norfolk, you had to be very accommodating and open to the spectrum of religious observance. So I don't think it was such a stretch for, again, some of it was more the mechanical things, learning to keep a kosher home, you know, being okay with explaining to the family, you know, I'm not going to be able to come to this thing. I'm not going to be able to go to this birthday. And she really paved the way for me. You know, for my mom especially, was very understanding because she'd already seen this with my sister. And it helps to have an ally. But to your point, I can't really tell you other than I don't think it was as difficult of a journey for her because she already was fairly traditional. Again, my brother-in-law's family was pretty open orthodoxy. I think they were reasonable. I don't know if that's the right term. I think they were just more inclusive being a fellow Southerner. And I always tell people, my wife's from Baltimore, I always joke, if you keep it below the Mason-Dixon line, you'll find some really nice Jews. There's a guy from Atlanta that wrote this book called Torah from Dixie, and I love it. The first page, it says, it's right out of Baba Basra and the Gemara. I mean, it's translated, a little poetic license says, he who wishes to be wise should go south. So that's the point.
I think you're right that the fact that this story takes place in the South, if it had happened in New York and New Jersey, I would think your future brother-in-law and your sister probably never would have met. Like, they wouldn't have been in the same social circles.
Precisely, yeah. And I'll tell you, if we have time, I'll tell you how my wife and I met. That's a crazy story, too.
And we'll get to your wife in a minute. I want to cover one more thing, which is this family that you started to go to regularly, and you mentioned it was kind of over 3 or 4 years, like this slow journey to becoming Orthodox. Were they almost like mentoring you and teaching you the steps and the things that you do as an Orthodox Jew versus where you were holding? Like, how did you start to learn about the things you would be taking on as you grew religiously?
Sure. So I think a couple of ways. I mentioned this Rabbi Estreicher going to his class every week. You know, he had 7 or 8 kids. So they'd talk about their bar mitzvahs and then weddings. So you learned about, so you'd be invited to their smachot and things of that sort. So that was a big part. And this couple, you know, had questions. We were very close and it was like, you know, it was like an adopted son. So it was a very easy way to learn or ask questions without feeling like a third grader, you know, trying to understand something. And they would understand, you know, if I was breaking my teeth on Hebrew, they would like, here's how you say this, that, that. So yes, there was tutoring, and it was, like I said, it was in steps. I would see them every Shabbos. And, you know, if I had questions, they were always available. And their sons, again, were closer to my age, and they'd come home from time to time. And they were very nurturing, too. Again, they were at YU or at law school or whatever. And yet, as a family, you know, they were quite helpful. So I think it was all of that between the rabbi, this family, the couple and their sons, and then my sister and brother-in-law. I can't cite something specific. Not having all the time in the world of medical school to really do a lot of research and learning, I think a lot of it was by osmosis and just being at the Beth Jacob at the synagogue with the classes. The Kolo, I should mention, had come to Atlanta. It's called ASK. They came there, Atlanta Scholars Kolo. You know, there was a class on tefillin. I remember when I bought my first pair. I mean, think about it. I got bar mitzvah. I think I just used the shul tefillin when I was 13. So, you know, at 22 years old, I bought my first pair, and they had a class every Sunday. It was a snail's pace chakras, which I loved. You know, they would sit there and wrap it with you and go through why we say this, not just here, say this and be done. Like, what's the essence? And the guy was... Sorry, Rabbi Goldberger. He was very excited. Menashe Goldberger was very excited about it. He explained why we do this. And, you know, he's like, here's the text and here's the Kavana. But, you know, I don't care if you're thinking about baseball. Think about how you're connecting the same way Avraham Avinu did. So there was a lot of little influences. But in that sphere, some of it was, again, being a Ben Bias. Some of it was the classes of the rabbi. And some was just, you know, seeing my sister. And again, it really paved the way. And that, you know, my family, thank God, my mother was very understanding and very open about it. You know, I think it was harder for her to explain to her friends, like, you know, why the kids weren't there this week for this, that, the other. So it was a lot of her, but thank God, she should rest in Shalom. My mother really was understanding, and that went a long way in observance. Having people that are on your team, whether they believe in it or buy into it, just to support you in your journey, I think is more important sometimes than your journey itself.
Continuing your story, so you graduate medical school. Let's now bring in the geographical move that I referenced in the introduction and also how your wife comes into the picture.
Okay. So I was very interested in oncology. I wanted to be an adult in pediatric oncology, and the place for that was St. Jude's in Memphis. So I was there for 4 years. I did internal medicine, pediatrics, and I was hoping to do an oncology fellowship. I liked Memphis for a couple of reasons. I was more observant already. I knew they had a strong community there. They had a neighborhood with homes and apartments, so I know I could live in the community. It was great medical community. So there were a lot of doctors in the shul. They have a medical school, a couple of, you know, a pediatric adult oncology hospital. So I knew it was the right place to live. However, it was somewhat lacking for dating opportunities. These are families that you know, Mary, if you ever read The Ladies' Auxiliary by Tova Mervis, the book about men, it's a great, it's fictional, but it's loosely based on their community, not so loosely. But true, families were very married in, so it wasn't a great place to date. So I found myself going fairly often to New York. Whenever I had a weekend or a week off or a few days, I was flying up to date. You know, I was already in my mid to late 20s at the time. So it was important to, you know, go to a place where I knew there was more chances on the Upper West Side for Shabbos and things like that. But interestingly enough, getting back to my sister, so I was kind of floundering as a nice Southern guy. I was not probably what most of these New York girls had in mind when they were dating. So my sister works at a job with a colleague who had another job working in Baltimore, D.C. and Baltimore. My sister lives in Silver Spring, in that community, are very close. So one of her colleagues, a woman named Linda, worked at another job in a hospital and happened to work with this man who's always talking about his daughter in PA school. And my sister is always talking about her aging bachelor brother living in New York. And this woman is African-American and not Jewish. Not that the two are mutually exclusive, but in this case, she wasn't. She's like, wow, you're the only Orthodox Jews I know. They should go out. And my sister's like, oh, I don't know. This kind of sounds half-baked. And my father's like, oh, okay, whatever. So he goes to my mother-in-law and tells her story. And you have to understand, I love my mother-in-law, but she's like the FBI, the CIA, the Mossad, everything rolled up into one. She knows more about me. She calls my rabbi in Atlanta. She calls people from Baltimore. She knows the whole story. And she says, oh, it doesn't sound so bad. So she calls my sister. And my sister's like, there's this girl from you. Next time you're in whatever, you should take her out. So that's the background to it. It's funny. So I called when we had our first child. I called my sister, and, you know, tell her mazel tov, we had a boy. And this woman, Linda, I've never met her. She picks up the phone. I go, I have to thank you. I would not be making this call otherwise. But that's the story, and you should understand. So my wife grew up in Baltimore, which is definitely more to the right than I am. Her father grew up religious. Her mom, she grew up in Canada probably at 13 or 14, I think through NCSY or whatever the Canadian equivalency is. So as much as they were ensconced in Baltimore and very traditional, my father-in-law wears a black hat. He's very traditional, but interesting because, again, he works in a hospital, so we had something in common. My wife was in PA school, so we clearly had something in common. So even though kind of like my sister and brother-in-law, a little bit further apart religiously, but yet I'd already worked my way in to better observance and learning, so it wasn't such a stretch for her to marry someone that wasn't necessarily Shomer Shabbos from birth. When I was interviewing after residency, I came to New York. I went to Einstein. Again, I was already fully religious. I figured it'd be a great place to do my training. And you know how we always say, well, we make a cheshbon or we try to bargain with Hashem. I said, you know what? I wasn't wearing a yarmulke yet, only at home and, you know, at synagogue and everything. I didn't wear one during residency. I said, you know what? I'm going to put it on for this interview. And if I get this position, I'm never taking it off. So when I got my fellowship, I said, okay, that's it. That's the last straw. Shomer Shabbos, fully observant kashrus, everything else. And I'm like, I'm going to be an outward Jew from now on. And I've never taken it off.
Wow.
I wear it every day to work. I have in my office, I have an American flag and Israeli flag. And, you know, I have mezuzot on the door. You know, you walk in here, you know what you're getting. It's funny, though. I'll tell you just as an aside. We're near the UN, so I get a lot of foreign dignitaries, and I get people from the Middle East. I get from Jakarta. They're ambassadors and things. So my last name's Field, so they walk in, and these guys are from the Middle East, and they don't know who I am. They see this American flag and Israeli flag. They're like, and you can tell what's going through, but they're very diplomatic. You know, they're very, and I guess I hope it's a Kiddush Hashem that they see me and I'm nice to them, but it's funny. So that's really the story of how I met my wife. The best thing about it, I tell people, is she was open, and this is important when people become new religious. I'm like, well, they're new religious. How do they know they're going to be, you know, trained? I say, you know, be open to the idea. I mean, you never know. But the point was, she was open to someone that didn't grow up religious, as my brother-in-law was. So, it, you know, it works out. And I think you have to, if you're going to be honest with yourself as a religious Jew, you know, this journey that people take is a very important part of who they are. And sometimes it really works out for the best. Thank God.
So I just want to check a couple facts from your story to make sure I have this right.
Sure.
You were in Memphis thinking you were going to go into oncology. She's from the Baltimore area, but you end up in New York as an allergist immunologist. So there must have been a couple of things that happened along the way.
Well, the basic thing is you should know, I should have told you that. St. Jude is the pediatric oncology hospital, and it was founded by Danny Thomas, Make Room for Daddy, Marlo Thomas's father. Part of their mission, it's funny, I always thought he was Jewish. He was of Lebanese descent. They would bring these children from the Middle East that basically failed all therapies to St. Jude. And after a year or so of doing it and watching these kids die and watching these mothers, you know, cry, like us, you know, we're cousins. They were very emotional. After a while, I'm like, this is not for me. I can't do this. You know, you knew going in that oncology is going to be a difficult thing, but this was even on a different madrig in terms of severity. So I went to my counselor and they said, okay, this isn't for you. What do you like? You know, what else are you interested in? I said, I liked the immunology. I found at the time, this nowadays it's de rigueur, but monoclonal antibodies and all these new therapies were just coming into being. I said, I like the immunology. And they suggest, well, why don't you do an allergy immunology fellowship? Why don't you look into that? And there was a great physician, a senior physician in Memphis, a guy named Phil Lieberman, amazing guy. I did a rotation with him and I really liked it. And so I said, okay, I'll do this. So at the time I was finishing up residency in Memphis and there was the option to go back home to Atlanta. Emory had a program. And then the other program I was interested in was at Einstein. And again, debating here and there, like going up to New York again, socially, religiously made a lot more sense at that point than going back to Atlanta. And then I think, you know, it was Shem Shemayim that the program in Emory actually closed. So that was no longer an option. So it's like, all right, it's 2 years. I can go to New York. I can sock it up. If I hate it, I hate it. I'll go back home eventually and hang my shingle. I was 23 years, wife, 3 kids, and in-laws 3 blocks away. I haven't quite made it back home to Atlanta. But the point is, you know, sometimes things, you know, it's beshared, it's meant to happen. So that's the short story of how I got up to Einstein and ended up in New York for a few years.
And I want to ask you a little bit more about wearing the kippah, because I'm picturing when a new patient comes in, and you're wearing them now, people can't see it because it's an audio podcast, but you have the stethoscope and you have the white jacket, and there are things that identify you as a doctor. And then the patient also sees the kippah. Do you ever have that moment of the person seeing it? Do you feel any vibes, good or bad, of what that means, of what kind of doctor you are?
Sometimes. I mean, it's not as much felt here. I think if you were, you know, in Kansas or Atlanta or something, you know, certainly here it's kind of hauling coals to Newcastle. Again, with some of the patients I see that are, you know, Muslim or something like that, generally it's not an issue. Or if it is, I don't feel anything to that. I think as long as you show care and compassion, you know, they're coming as a patient. And I like to say that medicine transcends a lot of problems we have. You always see in these Israeli hospitals, they're treating Arab patients or Muslim patients. But yeah, I haven't, and maybe I'm being naive, I haven't really felt it to be a problem. I mean, there's mezuzah on the door, you know, in my office, I'll have Israeli music on or something like that. You know, I have in my office, I have kamashim, I have gemaras, I have things like that. I think patients generally appreciate the empathy and the Judaism comes secondary, but they always, you know, are very respectful. I've been lucky. Would this be the same somewhere else? I don't know. Maybe in a Bible Belt, maybe even more. Who knows? But so far, it hasn't been a problem in the 20-plus years I've been wearing it every day.
Now, you ultimately chose to stay in the New York, New Jersey area, raise your family here, but you also have all this history of experiencing Judaism in the South. So you're really in a good position to kind of share with us the differences that you now see, having had kind of like half your life down South, half your life up here. What is Orthodox Judaism? How is it similar or different in those two places?
So I think the main similarity is you can always, you know, go to a family for Shabbos. You know, my friends back home, they're always fat, like, you'll go to someone's house you've never met before because you're going to a bar mitzvah, and they're shocked at that. I said, you know what? Jews have hospitality. Southern hospitality is legendary, but the nice similarity is there's almost always an openness that we experience. It was so refreshing when I was first becoming this. And I take that. And my wife's like, can we have these people over? I know you've had a long. I'm like, have them over. It's more on her than me. I just show up, you know, and make kiddush. But the point is, that's a very strong similarity. You know, I think it's lost on non-Jews outside of the South because they don't experience that. But I think it's very refreshing to see that, you know, 20, almost 30 years into my journey, to see that, you know, that's a common tie. And then the other thing is, you know, unfortunately with what's going on now with Israel, you know, I think everyone says, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, they say if we don't make Kedusha, they'll make Havdalah for us. I think people recognize that we have to stand together. And that's something you've seen, unfortunately, since October 7th. But it's always in our DNA. I believe that. I see that. Again, patients that really haven't been to a Shabbos table in 20 years, and they'll talk about some experience they have. I think that's great. So there's something we all have, the Pintle Yid or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, there's something we all have. And again, I feel like maybe Southerners can take a little bit more from the Northerners and Northern Southerners. But in general, at the end of the day, I really feel blessed that I've made this journey, that I've been able to take on more. I think about people that don't have Shabbos, that don't have observance, that don't have a community. And it saddens me, you know, from what we have. And I'm not just this idealistic pie in the sky. I mean, I live in the real world. I live in New York. I deal with, you know, all the things of being a parent and being in a community and, you know, being in the modern day we live in. But yet I really feel bad for people that don't observe it, you know, that don't have these quiet Shabbos afternoons, that don't have a Simchas Torah, that don't have to run their kids to drop off Shalach Manas. It's a joy. It really is. Really, what you're getting is such a privilege. And I think that as parents who didn't grow up religious and you see your kids, my son will stand up and, you know, he's 14 years old. He'll daven for the Amid. What do you give to your kids? That's, to me, part of the journey, too, what you see in the next generation. So that's something I'm exceedingly proud of. And, you know, as much as, you know, we complain, it's the greatest thing about the journey.
And that's what I hear loud and clear from your story is the enthusiasm you have for the journey you went on and what you've been able to pass along to your kids so they can have really what you didn't have and what I didn't have as a kid being in public school. So I just want to say I introduced you, Dr. Field, as an allergist immunologist. So thank you for giving us a shot to hear your story today on Saturday to Shabbos.
My pleasure. Everyone should be well and have a wonderful Shabbos. Thank you.
Saturday to Shabbos is produced by Gary Wallach. Our theme music is by Paul Uden. To learn more about us, please visit tachlismedia.com. That's TACHLIS media.com. Tell us what you think about what you've heard, or suggest a story we should know about by emailing shabbos@tachlismedia.com. I'm Jeff Cohen. Thanks for listening. Please check with us often for more stories of inspiring Jewish journeys. Saturday to Shabbos is a Tachlis Media podcast.